And a stat that I learned was that we on planet Earth are 7.5 billion eaters or consumers, and there's 1.5 billion farmers. And of those farmers, 500 million of them go to bed hungry. They get paid so little they can't feed their kids.
Welcome to the Social Fabric podcast with me, Andrea Splendori. And this week, my guest is Killian Stokes. Killian is a co-founder of Moi Ireland, a coffee company with a difference. In this conversation, we discuss the importance of social entrepreneurship, transparency, and how they are operating a fair chain business. Please subscribe, share, and review. It's the only way podcasts have a chance to survive. The songs in this podcast have been shortened for rights reason. You can find all songs on Social Fabric playlist on Spotify. The program is also broadcast every Monday, 4:30 p.m. on Dublin's Near FM 90.3. This week's show is in collaboration with Kambuka Ireland, suppliers of travel coffee mugs and bottles. Visit Kambuka_Ireland on Instagram or kambuka.ie and use the code SOCIALFABRIC at checkout for your 15% off.
Can I call you up, oh Alice, on a Friday night? We could reminisce on old days and we could talk a while. Just sit and talk a while.
Been so long. Okay, well, we'll get started then. Coffee, thanks.
You're very welcome.
Okay, so we get started here with Killian Stokes of Moi Coffee. Well, we'll get to the coffee in a minute.
Okay. Sure.
We are drinking your coffee at the moment, which is fantastic. But tell me, and I know we just had a quick chat about things before we switch on the microphone, but I always like to know where the person I'm talking to comes from. So just to give us a bit of an idea of the Stokes growing up.
Yeah.
There's quite a few of you, I think.
There is a few. There's a few of us here in Greystones now. Yeah, we grew up, I'm the youngest of five kids. We grew up in Blackrock. My dad's from Limerick, my mum, Richard Nailish, my mum is from Ringsend. And I was the youngest of five, four boys and the eldest sister. So I guess where we're sitting now is in fact my sister's kitchen. Two of my brothers lived here in Greystones. One has since migrated to France. But my sister's here, and during COVID I was here. She kindly lent me her house during COVID, so I was enjoying the benefits of Greystones. I was getting to swim in the mornings and run in the woods and try to work at the same time. I was the youngest of five. I could say that I was bullied by my older brothers and sister, but that would be a lie, I think. Like any big family, so. Yeah.
Where's that? Because I know your brother Dara and he's into his running and his swimming and stuff. Where's that come from? That old nature, being out in nature. Is it just the two of you, or all of you are into it?
No, I think. I mean, Dara was always very sporty. So when we were kids, I remember our parents every Sunday. The old Fiat we had living in Blackrock. Dad would load us all into the back of the car, and like sardines. And be driven down. We'd go down to Avondale or Glendalough, or so it was near. And I think sometimes Mum would have stayed home and maybe cooked dinner. It sounds very kind of old school, but it was probably a break for both of them. But we'd end up going hiking a lot on Sundays. We'd be brought up into the Wicklow, so I think that's probably where the nature thing came from. And then, Dara was sporty. I wasn't hugely sporty in school. I played a bit of tennis because in Sandymount, and a lot of my friends today now, we all met in a tennis club. There was a nearby tennis club. But I think then when I left school or college or started working and traveling a bit, I got into running at that point. And I guess with running, what's lovely is you just a pair of runners. You don't necessarily need special gear. And it is a lovely way to see the world, to go, you know, if you're in a city or a different country. I always love getting up early and I'm not a morning person, but I love getting out and certainly running around a new neighborhood or a new country.
Exploring,
you know.
And what about, so you mentioned Sandymount in terms of schooling and things, I'm always curious about the people in our lives, that when we look back, we go, oh, that was a bit of a role model for me. Was there anybody then in school that you can pinpoint to anybody, whether it was your friend or a teacher?
I don't know. That's a real... I went to a great school. We lived in Black Rock, and then we moved when I was about 10 or 12, we moved to Sandymount, which is where I started to play tennis. But where my brothers all went to Oatlands, I went to Clochdone. And so that school had a great ethos, a great sense of community. And so today, a lot of my really good friends are from Clochdone. And it's funny, the running thing, you know, one of the songs on my list is Kila, is Glanfime by Kila, which I is a song that I love to run to. And I'd say on my journey, the lads in Kila who live just the far side in Bray and stuff, that they played at a gig that I ran in the Sugar Club. I was doing a trek to Nepal. I don't know if you remember, there used to be, you know, you'd raise money for Concern, mm-hmm. and you'd go off on one of these treks. And at the time, that was around 2001, 2002, I put on a traditional Irish music night in the Sugar Club. A pal of mine was the manager of the Sugar Club, and because of school, I was able to get people like Cormac Tabara and the Osnuddies and a whole bunch of people played amazing music, and they helped me raise. And I actually raised we raised €10,000 for the work that Concern was doing. So that in a way was, for me, was they all kindly gave their time that night, and that started my journey as a fundraiser. I started to work, previous to that, I'd been working in the telecom sector, like the late 90s, just at the turn of the millennium. I was working in tech in mobile communications and internet companies, and really had a bit of a change 2002 when the dot-com bubble burst. I was kind of fed up with this all about driving subscriber money for mobile operators. That I didn't have any heart in it. So I did, you know, at that point it was very definite. I think it was 30, and I was like, okay, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? I don't want to work and just drive a stock price up, you know, work for a giant corporation and that be the purpose. So while that career had allowed me to travel and you know, work with mobile operators around the world, which was fabulous, it didn't resonate with me. So the Kila connection, that gig, I was sort of between jobs and trying to figure out my next move, and I decided, look, I don't know what I'm going to work at, but why don't I do this adventure? Why don't I sign up and go trekking in the mountains of Nepal and then figure out how to raise 10,000. I set myself a target. I said I'd try to raise €10,000 for Concern. And that gig that was part of that process. And that, this, I suppose, the success of that, being able to achieve that 10,000 target, then led me to become a corporate fundraiser as a job. Not go back into the tech sector, but go work for not-for-profits. And I went back to college as well at the same time. I went back and studied international relations over at DCU.
Okay, we'll go back to that. So the first song we're just going to play there, we're going to play the Tequila, which we've just been talking about.
My brothers, it's in some ways my brothers should have gone to Clochdone, because I have two brothers who are very musical, who play guitars. I did not. I'm the non-musical. My sister would sing, and my at family parties or whatever, my sister might sing, or my two brothers get out their guitars. I'll make the drinks or make the jokes or something. But you could see it in the school. It was on rainy days. You'd see people, you know, students who were musical were encouraged, and you'd hear them, and there'd be Kayleys, and there'd be, you know, concerts and things. So that was a great atmosphere to as an education as a school. It was a great place. And there is a strong community. I mean, Clean and Ivrenon was in class with me. You know, there's still a community, but we're still close to owners and close to East Gone. People are still well connected, obviously through social media, but you know, as friends and networks, it's a small crew, I suppose, or a small community.
And tell me about finishing school and getting into that first job, or that job in tech, where at the time everybody was getting into tech. You know, there was the money, that's where the money was.
Yeah.
Communication. So tell me about that journey, just before we get to the Paul trip.
Sure. I mean, I studied business and economics in Trinity. So it was a real generalist course, if you like. Really interesting, but, you know, I wasn't qualified as a doctor or a lawyer. So, and in that college year, in some ways, I think I used to spend my summers off in Germany or the States or in France, or, you know, working in Munich a lot of the summers, to pay for the college fees. And I think I learned as much in my summers as I did from the books in term and from the theory in college. But when I left college in the mid-90s, my two older brothers were working in tech, and they were both, they had done engineering and computer science, and they were traveling the world and they were making great money and getting to enjoy life. So I suppose that inspired me to look to the tech sector as an industry where, you know, when you're young, you could get to travel, you could do some interest. And also I was interested in the idea of tech changing the world. In college, I had studied a course, The Economics of Less Developed Countries, Professor Alan Matthews in Trinity. And I loved that course. And I loved the idea of technology. And it's still true. It's still at the heart of what I'm doing, is technology as a disruptive force, a leveling. I loved the notion that of virtual libraries, like that you could, with the internet, you know, in its infancy back then, but that the books that we had in libraries, the books that I had on my shelves and stuff, could be accessible all around the world. So I liked the idea that children in poor villages in poorer parts of the world would have access to this, would have the same opportunities, or the potential to have the same opportunities that you and I probably enjoyed in Europe. So tech, I was always excited. That's what excited me about tech. I suppose that's part of the reason I got into the tech sector. And would still, like when I left tech, I moved into the corporate fundraising, worked for some international NGOs, but then sort of left that and to become a social entrepreneur to set up. And it's probably 10 years now, 10 years ago that I set up my first social enterprise. And that was blending technology with, you know, charitable projects. It was online donations and
okay. Using. We'll get to that, because that's a really interesting part of what I want to talk to you about. But just tell me about the Nina Simone. I wish I knew how song.
Yeah, I suppose it's back to Here in Greystones. The last 4 years, Shane and I, my business partner, we've been building up Moi, we've been starting a company, and it was very much coffee at work. So like any startup business, it was a hard struggle. And we had, up in March, we had just achieved, we had 54 companies drinking our coffee, and we'd closed some really big deals. And this year was going to be great. It turns out we all drink 21 cups of coffee each week. And we drink 20 of the 21, we drink 15 when we're in the office. So we were selling, we had lots of nice tech companies and legal firms and creative agencies who were providing their staff with good coffee. So we were providing the machines and the beans. And obviously when COVID hit, that just all fell off a cliff. So our business died a death almost. So we had to reinvent or just find new markets. And we became an online business overnight, I guess. And there was a lot of scrambling and learning and trying to sell and get ads and connect with people. So I suppose, like a lot of people, being in COVID was this haze of, you know, not laziness, what's the word? Just your energy was sapped.
Fatigue.
And it was really difficult to get motivated. You were overwhelmed, and the lack of certainty. So it's like brain fog or something. So I felt the way to get back motivated, to get moving again, was get up in the morning. Here in Greystones was I used to get up at 6. I'd drive up to Kendalstown Wood. I'd run there for 30 minutes, and then I'd come back and make a pot of coffee and bring it to the beach and go for a swim, which is where we met down the beach one morning. But the Nina Simone song, when you wake up at 6 and you're not a morning person, you need music to get out of bed. And I think that song, when you listen to it, it just builds up. You can't but be filled with energy. It's an energetic, it builds pace. And she's an incredible songwriter and activist and singer. So yeah, it reminds me of my sister's house as well, and here that period in COVID.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear for the whole.
Now, I will get you a coffee, don't worry. But at the moment, I just want to go back a little bit at that Nepal gig and the 10,000 that got you into corporate fundraising. Because I know a couple of people in that world, and I've always been a little bit, and I always supported charities throughout my life, but I'm always a bit skeptical about charities and charity work and so on and so forth. So tell me a bit, why did you get into it? What did you do in that period of time you worked there? What in charity?
I think it's very healthy to be skeptical of charities, by the way. I think that's the default. We all should be, I think we should support charities, but we should educate ourselves as to where the funds are going. Okay. Getting into that world with Concern, I mean, I got to learn a lot about the 40 poorest countries in the world where Concern works. And I got to learn, and in the subsequent years, not just with Concern, but with Haven in Haiti, with Self-Help Africa, going on trips to West Africa, you know, to Burkina Faso, to Ethiopia, to Uganda, meeting communities and going on the ground, meeting a whole host of NGOs and seeing the difference they make. I think charity has a role to play, particularly when people are extremely poor. Basic healthcare for all, education for all, I think are human rights, clean water for all. I think we should all give money to that. And in some ways, the charities in those countries are doing the work that in our part of the world, the government carries out. But I think ultimately, the way for people to climb out of poverty is through work and it's trade. I suppose what I learned on those, and many of those, and that moved me on my journey, on standing in fields, meeting farmer communities, learning about value chains. And in particular, there was one trip in Uganda. I think I was on a trip of Concern, and I got a weekend off, so I went off hiking up to a place called Mount Elgon in southeastern Uganda. Beautiful old volcano, forest park with waterfalls, and it's a coffee growing area. And when I took a coffee tour while I was there as a tourist, a local guy, Steve, was a guide, walked me around for a day, and we met the coffee farmers. And these people are hardworking. They were desperately poor. They were dressed in rags. Their kids were skinny, and I could tell, you know, looked malnourished. The older people were sick and didn't have the ability or the money to go to doctors. And yet these people were working long hours and long days, and they were producing coffee, organic, high altitude coffee. And that was a light bulb moment for me and that got me on a journey. Like these people, when we, on that tour, we kind of stumbled out of the jungle onto a paved road. And as we're walking down that road, there was a factory on the mountainside, and it was sponsored or supported by Irish Aid, by the Irish government. And it was where the coffee would be collected, the farmers would get paid, and then the coffee would be shipped and exported out of the country. And the price of the farmers was chalked up that day. The price the farmers were getting paid per kilo was 30 cent. And a kilo here sitting in front of us, if you bought a kilo, you can pay between 30 and 50 euro. I looked at a bag last night on the internet. It was 48 euro for a bag of amazing coffee. So the farmer is earning about 1% of what you and I would pay for coffee in a supermarket here. And to me, I was like, you know, that's where charity can't, the value that exists in that community is not being enjoyed by that community. As my friend who used to run the Sugar Club, as he put it to me, kind of telling me my story back, he said, look, imagine if you told Irish people, you can grow barley, but you can't make beer and you can't make whiskey. Or you told French and Italians, you can grow grapes, but you can't make wine. Mm. It's like you're telling Ethiopians and Ugandans and Brazilians, I mean, within the, you can grow the coffee beans, but you can't roast them, you can't brand them, you can't profit from this beautiful drink. So for me, that mountain, that trip on the mountain in Mount Elgon was a game changer. I was like, okay, why am I giving charity to these people? Why am I raising money? Why are we raising funds to help these poor farmers with subsidize their life with charitable projects? Why don't we just pay them a fair bloody wage and let them pay for their healthcare, let them pay for their kids to go to school and put food on their own tables?
So we'll get to that now. So I'm going to have another cup of coffee because it's actually really nice. While you tell me about Eddie Vedder and the long road.
Yeah. I guess, and that kind of links to that mountain because one of my brothers, Ronan, lives in Seattle. And Seattle's an amazing city. It's very like Ireland in a similar climate. It rains a lot, but they get a slightly better summer than us. But it's got a fish market and food scene and coffee's a big thing. And that song, when I would travel over, I'd often go on holidays to Ronan and Liz and visit the family over there. And you get off the plane, kind of jet lagged, and my brother would collect me. He was always late, but when he'd finally collect me, he'd have a couple of coffees in the car, and he always had like some new music on. And so on that journey from the airport, like maybe an hour back to his house, he'd introduce me to some new music. And then we would always go to gigs. So some of the music would have been, you know, the albums of, like, so that song in particular, Ronan playing that in, you know, I have a memory of Ronan playing that in the car and the two of us driving back, me slightly jet lagged, but then drinking coffee, you know. And actually when I was Ronan was the brother who's into food and was into coffee and the fancy coffee machine at home and all that stuff. So when I was in Mount Elgon in Uganda and on that trip, walking along that road and later that evening when I was trying to make sense of it all, I rang my brother in Seattle, and when we were chatting, we were talking about coffee, and he at the time was saying to me, you should set up a company. You should set up a coffee company. And he said, here in Seattle, you know, that organic, high-altitude, mountain-grown Arabica coffee would sell for, as he said, like $50 a kilo. You should meet those local farmers. Now, I didn't at the time. I mean, I would love to go back. I hope with Moi as we grow it, I really want us to go back to that community, to we're currently selling Ethiopian coffee in Kenyan, but I want us to go to Mount Elgon and I'd love to flip that. But yeah, he kind of inspired me to, there's lots of great memories of drinking coffee and beers in Seattle and having home cooked food with Ronan and Liz and the family. And also him really being the inspiration behind Moi to that, you know, that he planted a seed maybe from that trip.
Drinking your coffee for the last few months, and I wouldn't call myself a connoisseur, though I was grew up in Italy and tried coffee in my life, but I'm not a connoisseur, but I really do enjoy the coffee. But that's beside the point, because, you know, some people like some coffee for different reasons, you know. But what I really liked about, apart from the taste, was the story behind, and really the fair chain principle was what caught my eye, because as I said, being skeptical that I am, you know, fair trade, you know, it's this stamp you see everywhere. I'm going, geez, you know, is it really, what is fair trade?
Yeah.
You guys took a completely different approach. So tell me this, you know, from coming back then, you when did it all start, the Moi, and did it all start?
Yeah, I you know, I had that conversation with Ronan on the phone probably in 2009 or 10. And in the interim, I went and lived in New York for a couple of years, but I was back in Dublin in 2015. And I was a bit burnt out and I think I was done with charity fundraising, and I was trying to find a job back here and trying to find my next steps and what would I work at. But I was always drawn back to, you know, I wanted to work in the space of development. I'm passionate about tackling extreme poverty, and particularly from what I've seen in places. So I guess my brain was working on it. How can I still contribute, make a difference in that space? And I was doing a course at the Innovation Academy in UCD. It was on that course I started to look at subscription services, and I started to think about that coffee again. And I thought maybe I could start to ship people month on month, bring them coffees. And I started to learn a bit more. Having seen that, you know, since being on that mountain, I started to learn about trade and economics. And I started to learn that actually Africa is the richest continent on the planet. The problem is the people of the continent don't enjoy their own value. It's all been exported out. And a stat that I learned was that we on planet Earth are 7.5 billion eaters or consumers, and there's 1.5 billion farmers. And of those farmers, 500 million of them go to bed hungry. They get paid so little they can't feed their kids. So, you know, all of those things, I started here in 2015 to think about coffee. And then in 2016, met up with Shane, and the two of us decided we were going to set up an ethical coffee company. We thought subscription service, maybe deliver people each month a different coffee from a different roaster in Africa. And I took a trip out and I did a bit of coffee hunting, went out to Uganda and Ethiopia at the same time, not really knowing what I was doing, but going around, just going into supermarkets, buying all the coffee, then turning the bag around, contacting the roaster, and trying to figure it out. And on that trip, we encountered Moi Coffee, this kind of Dutch Ethiopian collaboration, really bright pink bags, really funky brand. And I visited their roastery in Addis. Literally that trip, I mean, when I look back, I go, I followed my nose for 4 weeks in January around Africa, not really knowing what the hell I was doing. But they brought me up to the mountains. I went, drove up to see their farmers in the forest. And it was amazing to stand in a field. I mean, it reminded me of that other trip, but to stand there with shrubs that are growing coffee. I think with any product, whether you're growing herbs in your garden, it's exciting to trace it back. So Shane and I then decided, look, let's not reinvent the wheel. Instead of Shane and I trying to build something out of Ireland, and we had no money, let us go to the Dutch. So we flew over to Amsterdam. We got drunk with the Dutch guys. We liked they're quite blunt, the Dutch, but they were good fun. And we really bonded with them. We thought, okay, let's bring this to Ireland and the UK. Let's bring it to the English-speaking world. Because all of their bags were in Dutch. So we spent probably the first year just putting English stickers on Dutch bags. So we were able to learn from them. They gave us a line of coffee. They gave us like 20 grand worth of free coffee. So it kept us going for a few months to build the business, get the business going. And I mean, we both had part-time jobs. And I think in our first year, we didn't pay ourselves. And then our second year, we were starting to get the business up. We were able to pay ourselves every 2 months. Like any entrepreneur, it's a bit of a struggle, that kind of journey. But yeah, it started from there, I think.
Brilliant. I love the way you follow your nose, because again, I think that normally it's more than the nose. Normally it's just the heart that's involved. You know, when you really believe in something, you know, you find what's there for you. But I'm going to ask you a little bit more about that. But I see behind you the Springsteen box set, Across the Border is the song you picked.
So I guess I mentioned my brother Ronan and in the States and Orna, whose house we're in. But I have two other brothers, Connor and Dara, they're the musicians in the family. They're the guitar players. So this song for me, or in fact that album, for me, it reminds me of the nights when we get together as a family, either in a bar or back in the house afterwards, the guitars come out and the guys, we start singing everything from Christy Moore to Bruce Springsteen. And some of the tunes on that album, including this, would be ones that Connor and Dara and myself would, you know, when mostly those two, but with a few beers involved, you know. It's one of the songs where, yeah, I'll join in. But it's a beautiful album as well. It's my favorite, personally, it's my favorite Bruce Springsteen album, and it's 20 years old. And it's, you know, as a storyteller, it's an album all about migration and the struggle of the migrant. And I think it's as relevant today. It's, if it was written yesterday, it would be as topical today. And it's something like, even in terms of the coffee thing, I remember going on a fundraising trip to Boston and being at a gala ball there. We were serving our coffee at the ball, and I was spending a lot of time, it was kind of a black tie tuxedo ball, and I was spending most of my time in the kitchen with some of the catering staff who were from all over the world, a lot of them from South America, and trying to get the coffee right, because the machine over there was a completely different machine. So I was sweating it that I was going to serve lousy coffee. So there was these two lovely ladies there who were from South America, and they were like my coffee experts, and they were tasting it. I was like stirring and trying to get the recipe right. But chatting to them, the folks who were there, they all knew, they all said, coffee farmers are like the poorest of the poor. And one of the challenges is when coffee farmers get a little bit of money and they get slightly higher up, they often migrate. So in Central America right now, lots of coffee growing communities, because it's so hard, because they get paid so little, because it's so unpredictable, a lot of coffee farmers or their sons and daughters are leaving the land. They're saying, screw this, this is too hard. And they're trying to go north across the border. So.
Tonight my bag is packed. Tomorrow I'll walk these tracks. That'll lead me across the border. Tomorrow my love and I. We'll sleep neath auburn skies. Somewhere across the border. We'll leave behind, my dear, pain and sadness we.
I think it's all connected. I mean, it's...
And I love. So, just tell me a little bit more about then what you guys are doing to tackle all that, to make the difference. And you are making the difference. You just, gave me the first Impact Coffee Club, which we discussed on the beach that day. But tell us a bit more how you progress in this fair chain idea and how the communities down there are actually benefited from what you can actually see.
I think what we're doing is like a 10-year experiment. I think it's going to take time for it to really shift. But we are working right now with two very specific farming communities. And our principle with Fair Chain is we hope to bring about four different changes. The first one is roasting in the coffee belt. All coffee on our planet is grown in and around the equator, but 99.99% of coffee is roasted in the West. So we have a roastery in Addis, the capital of Ethiopia. So that's a start. That's a bit of a game changer. Let's shift the value back into coffee growing countries. The second thing, though, is living income for farmers. That is crucial, and that's something we've learned, and it's going to take a long time. But our typical coffee farmer earns about 400 euro a year from their coffee harvest. They subsidize that by growing their own food. They really are very, very poor. So we pay them a 20% bonus. We bring them up to maybe 500 euro a year, but that's not enough. What we've calculated is a living income for those families, and a typical family might be seven in numbers, you take grandparents involved, they need to be earning 1,050 euro a year to really be out of poverty. And that's the target. If we don't achieve that, then what's the point? So that we've got a series of interventions. We've been, as well as a business, we've been fundraising the last 2-3 years. Just even here in Ireland, Shane and I, we've raised about €1 million in partnership with Irish Aid and very kindly the AADP, Irish Aid and the Department of Agriculture, Self Help Africa. And that is to acquire assets. So we've bought a washing station at one town, Limuganet. We pretty much paid for half of the washing station there. And there's a second area, Mezen Teferi, and we are building a washing station. We're building a climatized storage facility that the coffee will stay good for longer. We can help the farmers secure a higher price. And we're also building a road, better access for those farmers. The first thing is roasting at origin. That makes a big difference. More money and jobs staying in the coffee belt. Second thing is bring the farmers to a living income. Take a roadmap, training to give them better ecological agricultural practices, help them increase their yield, help them increase the quality of their beans. We did this year, we built a nursery and we have distributed, there's 120,000 saplings being grown, so giving them younger coffee trees, helping the farmers circle, you know, to replace their stock of coffee trees with younger, more bountiful, you know, so that they can increase their harvest. And then giving them a higher price, acquiring assets like the washing station, the idea is to transfer ownership and starting with profit share of those assets back to the farmers. So a living income for the farmers has become kind of our central focus. But then if you add on to that, the more we started out with economics in mind, but you learn about ecology and the environment and climate change, and coffee is a major cause of, our desire for coffee is causing deforestation all over the world. We are only 4% of coffee on our planet is grown in a forest. That coffee there, the single origin, is forest or shade grown coffee. So when it's grown in a forest, it supports an ecosystem. It supports migratory birds. It gives farmers firewood. And actually, from a flavor point of view, coffee grown in a forest has a lot more going on. And so we're trying to promote forest grown coffee and also carbon neutral coffee. We're looking to do a project in Kenya, which has kind of been delayed, obviously, because of COVID. But how can we make it more sustainable? That's one. I'm not saying I'm pessimistic about it, but I'm very optimistic about the living income. I can see it. Every time I go back, I can see improvements. I'm optimistic when I go to the roastery and I meet the team, you know, urban jobs. I can see how that value will change. How can I get us, or how can we as consumers become more aware? That's a tougher challenge. Like within the coffee world or the coffee industry, if you want to talk about sustainability of coffee, the war is all about the tree standing in the forest. It doesn't matter if I deliver that to you in a plastic bag, a recycled bag. Hopefully it's a recycled bag and fully compostable. We should be doing those things. And we shouldn't, you know, we currently ship some of our coffee by air freight, so that has a huge carbon footprint. We want to get on, as we scale, we will get onto boats. But the real carbon footprint is the forest. If the trees are gone, then, so this coffee here, as it's CO2, taking into account that this is not a recyclable bag and it's flown here, it has less than half the CO2 of a normal kilo of coffee. Normal kilo might have 8 to 9 kilos of CO2. That has about 4, I think it's 3.7, and it'll go down further if we get onto boats as opposed to airplanes. The fourth one, sorry,
yeah, go on.
Because it comes back to your point earlier on, is, so our fourth element that we want to do is radical transparency. So I don't want you just to sit and trust me that this coffee is doing good. We are using blockchain, and again, this is the partners of South Up Africa and the IRSA, the AADP, Department of Agriculture involvement. It's, we're using blockchain. And again, I guess that goes back to my technology background. We want to digitize the value chain. So right now, every time we pay our farmers, we're capturing that information digitally so that you can see exactly. And the goal is, in the next few months, we want to have a bag. So you walk into a supermarket, pick up a bag, take out your phone, zap the bag with your phone, and you can see exactly who got paid what on the journey of that coffee and where the carbon was added. So this, I think this is going to be a game changer if it's, you know, in the next few years, where we as consumers can pick up products and see the carbon footprint, see the provenance, really know where that product came from and who got paid what, and see or prove, be able to prove to ourselves that the workers and the farmers and the people involved got paid a decent income, that it's not greenwashing, or that we don't have to be skeptics, you know?
Yeah, yeah. No, I hear you. Okay. So tell me about this, and you better pronounce it, Malatu Astake?
I'm probably going to pronounce it badly, Malatu Astake. He is a famous Ethiopian jazz musician. His music was probably became quite popular or more widespread in the movie Broken Flowers. You might remember that with Bill Murray. But it's a beautiful jazz. To me, it's the sound of Ethiopia. Like, Ethiopia is, I'd say, my favorite country to travel to. It's so rich. It's so diverse. It's got beautiful landscape. It's great for hiking. Amazing coffee, obviously. But they have this lovely, there's music everywhere. And they have this very unique jazz culture, you know, and music unlike anywhere else. They have this, they've 13 months, they have their own script. It's like going to a different planet in some ways. It's a beautiful country. And so for me, his music, when you land, you hear the music everywhere. And actually the town he was born in is Jima, which is the town where our, it's the region where our coffee comes from. It's the, you fly into Jima, which is a big kind of city, agricultural city up in the mountains in western Ethiopia. And so yeah, that just, that music to me represents all things Ethiopian, and those great, like, you know, the best week of the year I would have is the week when I get to fly to Ethiopia to go see the farmers and meet them over the harvest festival. It's you know, when the cherries are being brought in, it's an amazing privilege to be there, you know, to trace that.
Describing the growing in the mountains. When I lived in India, one of my best friends there looked after a few coffee plantations. So I can picture it. It's the most spectacular vegetation because the coffee needs different shades of different, so depending on the mountains, that's what he remembers playing if it's on.
And the colors are beautiful.
It's south facing, north facing, so there's oranges growing, there's all sorts. Mm. It's amazing. But coffee is such a commodity, it's such a big, you know, we drink so much coffee worldwide.
Mm. Yeah, massive.
Massive. And that idea of growing on the mountain top, it's probably a little bit utopian, is it? In terms of having, I mean, the majority is still going to be farmed and deforestation will be part of it. But from your point of view, as you grow the business, which obviously is a business, a social entrepreneur, but is a business, is it much more that you can develop within, you know, growing on the mountains? You know, that farm you're dealing with, is a lot more space that you can utilize to grow your, and a lot more farmers to deal with it.
There's definitely, long term, there's definitely efficiencies that can be brought into agriculture. I mean, we've seen it in, say, Europe and America. We don't all farm anymore. There's much fewer farmers now than, say, 150 years ago in Ireland. Is it sustainable for, like, typically our coffee farmers might own 2 hectares of land about the size of 2 rugby pitches or 2 football pitches. They'll grow coffee on 1 pitch. They'll live in the equivalent of quarter of a football pitch, and they'll grow some food on the rest of it. Is that sustainable long term? I think some advances need to take place in farming, but what we definitely need is, I think we as consumers need to pay more, or certainly more of what we pay needs to go back to those communities, to invest in the mountainsides. And if you are growing coffee in fields, to protect the environment. Like, one of the things that gets to me is if I was to sell my coffee into a supermarket, and you, let's say you bought a bag of our coffee for €8, the supermarket is taking 4 of that. The supermarket and the distributors. Now maybe I shouldn't be saying that, because we do want to get into supermarkets. We've had meetings with supermarkets in the UK and in the States, and that is for us as a business to scale, to be able to support more farmers. But the margins that currently exist, the industry standards, the notion that the middleman and the supermarkets take such a huge piece is crippling. And I think we need to share the price more fairly across the band, and if that means with some products we need to increase, I mean, that fact is true whether you're talking beef farmers in Ireland or milk farmers or fruit and veg. Mm-hmm. I think we do need to redesign our business models for food, and I think technology has a huge role to play in that.
So if you're saying that whatever the cost is today of the farmer gets paid, you say around €400, $400.
Yeah.
You're bringing it up to 500, and ideally it needs to be double that. Plus, yeah. 1,100. Yeah.
Double or triple.
Double or triple that. But for that to happen, it's that chain you're talking about. By the time it gets to my cup, there are so many steps that everybody needs to take a slice of it, and then whatever I pay for a kilo of your coffee, everybody has made some money along the way, including the farmer. But by pushing it down through the roastery, I get that. But why can't the farmer be paid more now?
With us, we're a small business, so we don't have the capital to invest in up right straight away, and I mean you could talk about socioeconomic changes, but that's a very good question, and we don't necessarily have the capital to pay that now, but there's many inefficiencies in the general supply of coffee, and I think so farmers should normally get paid a couple of months after their harvest. And if they're lying around, you know, if they're waiting to get paid, they end up going to loan sharks, whatever, you know, taking. So that's introducing middlemen middlemen who will buy their cherries and say, look, I'll pay you cash today. So particularly with commodities, and that's where I say the storage facility is important, because we can empower the farmers to store their coffee and pay it, sell it later when supplies are lower and there's a better price. So efficiencies in the value chain, paying the farmers sooner, that's something we've done, and we're digitizing. So our farmers, just over the last harvest season, we got them all bank accounts, and we started to pay them, and those access to financial products makes a difference. But that simple question, you're right. Is it possible to just triple income from where we sit? It's not.
No, because obviously there's also the other aspect, which, you know, you're just one of the companies dealing there. You're one of the smaller, perhaps, and then, you know, disrupting that idea. If that your farmer is starting to get paid more than the farmer from whatever the giant coffee manufacturer that do all the farming.
The thing is, at a global level, coffee is arguably the world's favorite drink. We drink 2 billion cups of coffee every day. And globally, it's an industry worth 100 billion euro, $100 billion. There are 100 million farmers, coffee farmers, which I think is something like 1 in 70 human beings on planet Earth is a coffee farmer or relies on coffee. So 100 billion, and yet 90% of those coffee farmers live on less than 2 euro a day. The margins in coffee, as we know, it's a booming industry. In some sections, the margins are massive. Because of what we're doing, our business model is slightly different. We, you know, our business here in Dublin, and in Amsterdam, we live on a much tighter margin, because we're sending, I suppose, some of the revenue or the profits, diverting it for those extra payments. But we're still not big enough to be able to just jump prices up. So, and that's why we have this twofold. We have the business where we're buying coffee, we're buying the whole harvest off the farmers, and we're selling it to our customers, and we're committing to buy the coffee off the farmers for the next five, you know, we're committing long-term relationships with those farmers. And then in tandem, we're raising, you know, aid money, grant aid through the Fair Chain Foundation to invest in training sessions, to invest in infrastructure, in storage facilities. Mm-hmm. And in machinery, and like we brought a machine in recently, we purchased a machine, again supported by AADP, from South America, to the new washing station in Maison de Ferry. So we're a small business trying to change a global business, I guess.
It starts from somewhere.
I mean, that's where I describe the whole thing as a 10-year experiment. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you say about the impact. I'm not saying we have impact yet. I think we have the bones of a model, and also you learn. Like, it's sometimes two steps forward and one step back. Like in the early days when we were talking with the farmers about changing the trees, a lot of the trees that our farmers were growing might be 60 years old, and the harvest is not so big. So we were saying, look, plant these new trees. Yes, it'll take 3 or 4 years for them to bear fruit, but between the age of 5 and 20, these trees will give you much more cherries. But then the resistance was, well, these trees were planted by my father. I can't chop them down. So you've, there's having to understand the mindset, like pruning of trees. You're introducing new practices or composting, where you're basically taking dung, you know, the goat dung and mulching it and stuff like that around. Well, if people don't have access to clean water, they don't necessarily want to spend all day long with their hands covered in cow and goat dung if they can't wash them at the end of the, you know, there's realities. And they, farmers also, I think, certainly the coffee farmers, the long term, they live much more of a day to day or season to season. So the price today is the price today. That it's, you're trying to balance our strategies or, you know, our focus here with theirs. So I think it's a 10-year experiment, the whole, like, it's a learning curve, and you just hope you we're doing, you know, we're going in the right direction. But I you know.
Yeah. No, not here, and it's great. And tell me something about this Wyvern Lingo passion fruit.
Yeah, this is a band from Bray. What's great, you know, we're here trying to find our tribe as a coffee company and now as an online business. And the girls are big fans of our coffee. So, I was delighted. I think Karen from the band was talking about value chains and commented on one of our posts. And she had spent time in Africa and absolutely understood the challenges of, we need to be talking about more value staying in country. We need to be talking about farmers and living income. I listen to music when I work from home. So through our interaction with our customers, I learned about this band. I started listening to the music, and I'm kind of addicted to it. It's my go-to when I'm during the day. I listen to them. So it's a great tune, and they're a great band.
Just before we come to the end, I want to go back a little bit, just pre-COVID, because you had momentum, you had companies buying into your coffees, they were providing good coffees to their staff. But again, if we go back to my point that, yeah, I like your coffee, but that's me. The next guy might not like it, prefers, I don't know, some Italian brand. But why were the companies buying into it then? Was it because of what you're doing? And as well as doing what you're doing now online, and hopefully this COVID will eventually kind of calm down a bit and leave us all to go back to some sort of normality. What are people looking for in the, you know, they were so addicted to coffee anyway. What are the reaction you're getting from your customers?
I mean, coffee is like the petrol for human beings. We run on, our economies run on coffee. We all need our morning coffee. For us, why companies are buying or are supporting us, they love the taste of the coffee. I mean, this coffee is a specialty coffee. So our beans grade in like the top 5% of beans in the world. It's all grown in, you know, organically and in a forest. So the flavors, and we have a variety of flavors that we offer to different, because as you say, not everybody enjoys the same coffee. But yeah, for the most part, the companies really liked the ethos of that we're trying to promote sustainability, forest-grown coffee, that we're trying to disrupt the business model, change things for farmers, see more value, shared value, see more value stay in those farming communities. And the idea of roasting in the belt, people love that. It makes sense. It's very obvious. Why is coffee not? If the French make wine, you know, they don't export the grapes, they make the wine in France, same in Italy. Why are the Ethiopians and Brazilians not doing the same or getting to do the same? So it is the ethos that has connected companies to us. But we often say we're the world's least unfair coffee company, because as you highlight, that €500 a year is still not fair for those farmers. So we've a long way to go, you know.
And tell me about this Impact Coffee Club. What do you do with it? Yes. And what is it all about?
So when COVID happened, we started over COVID, we were trying to scramble and figure out how we can support, how do we protect the chain? How do we stick to our commitments to our farmers? We had pledged before we will buy the full harvest, year on year for the next couple of years. So that we're sticking with that. So then our challenge is, okay, we're definitely buying all the coffee. How are we going to sell it? How are we, you know, online? And we built up over the last couple of months. We started to gift it at the very beginning. You'd buy 1 kilo of coffee and we'd gift a kilo to either a friend of yours or we'd gift it to frontline workers. So we were dropping in shipments to various hospitals and around the country. But we then decided, you know, and that built us a bit of an audience online. People loved the coffee we were starting to drink, changed their habits working from home. So we thought, okay, let's get an Impact Coffee Club, give us a little bit more certainty, and let's build this small tribe or group that would commit to buying our coffee month on month, and we will then bring them on our journey of impact. So that community, those coffee drinkers here in Ireland, we will month on month share stories with postcards, maps, newsletters. We'll tell them specifically about the impact, bring them on that journey with us, with the farmers, whether it's building the roads or the new harvest or the washing station, as well the good as well as the, you know, the couple of steps backwards. I mean, some of the challenges obviously we're facing now are the logistics of the shipping of the coffee. Can we keep that supply routes open? So that is where the club is you know, get folks to come on the journey, and I'll be sending them multiple emails. Like, we'll do a monthly newsletter and have it. And also there's a saving, like people are starting to drink a lot of coffee. You deserve a bit of a discount if you're going to be sticking with us. And you can join online. Yeah, it's at moicoffee.ie. Okay.
I'll put a link on the show notes anyway, so that people can.
That would be join. Yeah. That would be.
But tell me something. So I came in here. We're in your sister's house, and you presented me with a lovely cup of coffee. But as I was saying, I grew up in Italy, and we had a mocha. And even when I go back now and I ask for an Americano, people just say, what's wrong with you? You know, espresso is where it's at. But I came in, you were measuring, I think you were weighing the coffee, the amount of coffee, were you?
Yeah.
That's kind of beyond my understanding.
When you start to work in the coffee industry, you ultimately become a coffee snob. Coffee is like, the one thing I learned in coffee is, if you do nothing else to improve the coffee in your life, buy yourself a grinder. I mean, you can get them in Argos for 40 euro, 50 euro. Grind your coffee fresh every morning. That will radically improve the quality of your coffee. But then the other thing is, coffee is like a recipe. It's like making a chocolate cake or something. If you know what the recipe is and you just repeat that every time. So we're using a French press, which a plunge pot, which most of us use. I've put 50 grams of coffee, which is about 5 tablespoons or heaped cereal spoons of coffee, and I've put 750 grams of water, and that. So if you think of it, 5 spoons to is kind of the right ratio to get a nice cup of strong coffee. Coffee is, and I know we don't always have the time to do it, but if you do have the time, getting the difference, if you put too much coffee or a spoon too little, it's either too watery or too strong. I mean, it's kind of a bit like the Goldilocks with the porridge. But, you know, coffee, when the recipe is right, it's amazing. It is so, certainly we should all grind our coffee. But if you have time, definitely get a weighing scales and you know, either Google, or we're going to be starting to share more of those brew guides. Find the coffee you like, get the recipe that you like, and try to replicate it. You know, that's the best way to get a good cup of coffee.
And it's a lovely cup of coffee. But what strikes me from all that you've told me the last hour or so, that you really do take the time to appreciate what's in front of you, whether it's a cup of coffee or a mountaintop. And, you know, if it was somebody else walking around the mountains of Uganda, probably just would have seen the mountain, they wouldn't have seen the rest of it. So it's great that you took that little inspiration, your brother's cup of coffee, and all of that brought you to where you are today, which is it's a great way to get to a nice cup of coffee. There's a lot more than just the 50 grams there. That's what I'm enjoying.
Probably. I mean, it's a nice coffee is a great way to start your day, and it's a nice journey. It's a nice product to be, you know, the one thing where, whether times are good or bad for us, is, you know, when you're struggling as a business, there's always great coffee in the cupboard. So that's not, it's nice that we're, it's a great industry to be in, you know, it's a beautiful product. And to have the opportunity to walk right back to where, I mean, the best cup of coffee ever is where you're sitting on the mountain where it's grown and you make a cup of coffee there. It's amazing, you know, but I guess that's true of any food. You know, if you make bread, or if you grow fruit or herbs in your garden or whatever, it's always, or even salad, it's there's a real buzz to it, I think, you know.
Absolutely. So before I let you go and ask you the last song, tell me what I ask everybody, what I call the words of wisdom, your quote, what gets you up in the morning, anything at all?
Oh gosh, I mean, it's like bumper car sticker stuff, is it? I mean, I think we've won life. I think you've gotta suck the marrow out of life, you know? You've gotta enjoy. I think you've two jobs as a human being. One is you have to enjoy your life. So get out there, explore, learn, travel, you know, really use that gift. And then the second thing is you have to use your life to make the place better, to help people or the planet. And I think those are like, you have to do both of them. You can't just all be about helping the planet. You can't just all be about helping yourself. You've got to enjoy your life, but also make the place better, make the world a better place for humans and for the planet, you know.
I like that. And what did you pick as the last song? You were torn between two of them.
Yeah, I think maybe Dreams by the Cranberries. And I'd said to you, this reminded me of a summer when I was in college, but working in factories like BMW factory down in Munich, as a lot of Irish students did. And there was eight Irish students living in a one bedroom apartment. And when we weren't working in these factories, we only had two albums with us, both with the Cranberries. So we literally listened to the Cranberries on loop for the whole summer. And never got tired of the two albums, and we drank German beer and we'd sit around drinking German beer and listen to the Cranberries. So I think this song reminds me of that summer. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, Killian Stokes, thanks a million for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.